You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Peter Hessler joined the Peace Corps in 1996 and moved to a small town in the Yangtze River, China was a very different country from the one that we know today. He witnessed many social and political changes and reported on them for more than a decade. His new book, Strange Stones, is a collection of his writings from China, the United States, Nepal, and Japan for The New Yorker, National Geographic, and a number of other publications. The book is from Harper, and I'm very pleased that it brings Peter Hessler to our show today. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've dedicated your book to John McPhee. Didn't you take a course with him at Princeton?
Yeah. When I was a junior in college, I took his writing course. And
well, that must have been an important course if you actually dedicate the book to him.
Yeah, although, I mean, to be honest, it has more to do with what was after the course than during. I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, the course did – it was the first time I realized that nonfiction writing might be something I want to do, because I intended to be a fiction writer, and I always – thought journalism was just news, basically, and didn't have a very sophisticated understanding of what a narrative nonfiction writer would do. And he opened that up to me. But really, a lot of the reason that I'm grateful to him is that over the years since I finished college, he was always in touch and encouraged me. And it's a hard career, and it helps to have somebody like that who's telling you if things are good ideas or not.
Well, in your preface, you also mentioned that your father is a teacher and a medical sociologist. Did that have an impact on your career?
Yeah, an enormous impact. My father's a sociologist at the University of Missouri. He's now retired. But, you know, as a child, I went along with him to interviews, and I would see how he'd interact with people and how he spoke with people. He's also just a very curious, outgoing person, and that's good to see if you're going to be interviewing people. And he's a big storyteller, and I think that impacted me as well.
Did you join the Peace Corps with journalism in mind?
Not specifically. I had always wanted to join the Peace Corps, and it's hard to tell exactly where that comes from, but it probably is partly because, it has a lot to do with my parents. My parents spoke very highly of the Peace Corps.
Had they been in it as well?
They had not, partly because they married young and had kids. But, it's funny. There's a lot of Peace Corps volunteers, actually, who have a Catholic connection. And my family's Catholic, and I think it's because of Kennedy, basically. So I think that's one of the reasons my parents saw this as a good thing to do.
Well, by the time you joined, we're talking about, 35 years after it was created. You joined in 1996. Had it changed much?
Oh, enormously. I mean, I think it's a fascinating history of the organization, but it started with this incredible idealism, and there were huge numbers, in the early years. And it actually became a much smaller program. It was damaged a lot by the Vietnam War, to be honest. I mean, there was much less idealism, and people were more likely to feel like, I don't want to work with the government or for the government in the developing world. And some countries would use it as propaganda. When we went into China, it was very sensitive because for many years, the Chinese government had said, the Peace Corps is connected to the CIA, or these volunteers are, working as propagandists for the, for capitalist systems and so on. So so when I went in, it was a very different moment. A lot of people would say, does the Peace Corps still exist? I didn't even realize that.
Is it still funded by the U.S. government?
Yeah, it's funded by the State Department. Yeah,
but you arrived in China after Tiananmen Square, so China had changed a lot by the time you arrived as well.
China was sort of entering this boom period, although I don't think that had really been recognized yet. And this was the early stages of it. And so when I was teaching there from 96 to 98, you could see these things happening, and you didn't quite realize the impact of them. For example, migration. I mean, many of my students were writing in their class assignments about relatives and sisters and brothers who were migrating to the factory towns. And so you started to get a sense, this is really a big deal for these people. And you could see these transitions happen even on campus. I mean, I taught 2 years, my first group of seniors that I taught, and they graduated. All of their jobs were assigned by the government. They were sent to different schools around Sichuan to teach. By my second year, that was done. It's find your own job. We're not supporting that anymore, And so this was the sort of shift that was happening all over China as the government was basically ending control of a lot of economic aspects of people's lives.
How long after you arrived did you start writing about it?
I mean, I was keeping a diary from day one, but I didn't think of myself as writing about it formally. I mean, really, when I entered the Peace Corps, I hoped to become a writer, But I felt like I had a long way to go. You know, I had published, you know, some travel stories and things like that. But I wouldn't have expected that I would write a book at the end of those 2 years. So I just kept a diary, partly to process things. I had a lot of time. You know, this is pre-internet. I didn't have phone contact with people in the States. There's only one other English speaker in the town. So basically all you're doing is learning Chinese, and then I'm writing just to process what's going on, a very intense experience. And it wasn't until the very end of those 2 years that I started to think about it. And really that's one of the reasons I dedicated this book to John McPhee, because he wrote me a long letter when I had about 6 months left in the Peace Corps. I had sent him a note asking about, you know, what would you suggest doing for the next step? And he said, you should write a book about fooling. You know, I've read your letters, and this is an interesting place. And that clicked for me. And suddenly I realized, you know, that I had something to, you know, a story to tell.
But you weren't just writing a book. You were writing pieces for various magazines. Is that
later, yeah.
Is that an easy thing to do? You just send in something saying, hey, I've been living in China now for a while, and I have an interesting piece about sports, for example.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was in the Peace Corps, I wasn't doing much freelance writing. I mean, I wrote a couple of travel stories, but basically it was – so I finished, and then I wrote my first book, Rivertown. And then that was in 99, that was finished, the beginning of 99. And so I was actually applying for journalism jobs in the States, and I couldn't get anything.
So you stayed in China?
I went back. I was in the States at that point. I couldn't get a journalism job in the States, so I said, okay, I'll go back to Beijing, and I'll just try to set up as a freelancer. So,
well, isn't Beijing expensive, more expensive than living in that village?
Not in 99. It wasn't very expensive. It was, you know, I mean, And believe me, I was just straight out of the Peace Corps, so I think I had my apartment might have been $200. It was a pretty bad apartment, you know.
Do you think that you were able to establish good relationships with your students? People are rather circumspect around foreigners, aren't they?
Yeah, and you know, and especially at that time, and I was in a town that was pretty remote. You know, me and the other volunteer were basically the first Americans to be there since, you know, the revolution in 49, the first ones to live there. But, you know, you spend 2 years with people and you teach them for 2 years and the relationship changes, you know, and they learn to trust you and I learn to trust them.
And you wound up having an exchange of emails with a former student named Emily, or at least that's her English name. She eventually moved to a city called Shenzhen. Now, that is where a lot of people move to, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, especially at that time, people from Sichuan, where I was teaching, there was a lot of migration in that direction, and her sister had gone there. So even when I was teaching her, she would often write about what she was hearing from her sister. And then she graduated at the end of my first year, and she went to Shenzhen, and so we stayed in touch. And that became something that once I started writing, I went down there and followed her story.
Is the story opposite to Horace Greeley's advice? Go east, young man, young woman in China?
I think so. It's different in the sense that they're not discovering a new frontier. You know, they're going into this incredible factory, you know, environment. But it is the opportunity of that generation is, you know, to go to the south and to the east.
And she worked as a secretary in a factory. What did she tell you about what was going on in the factory?
A number of things. I mean, one thing that concerned me a lot was that there were various bosses, you know, middle-aged men who ran the factory who were surrounded by it, because almost everybody in that factory was a young woman, which is very common in Shenzhen. It's, you know, most of the people would prefer to hire young women. And you talk to a manager and they would say, hey, you know, the girls work harder, they're easier to control, they don't start fights the way the men do. And it's really, you go down there and that's really what you see are young women on the street. But, you know, some of these men would prey on the girls, you know, who are very young and often from very unsophisticated backgrounds. And so she would write a lot about this. She was, you know, an incredibly intelligent and sensitive person. And there were times when I was, you know, concerned about the environment that she was in.
And then you visited, and mm-hmm. She introduced you to a famous nighttime radio show host, a woman?
Yeah, yeah.
What was that show like?
Pu Xiaomei. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, because, you know, at that time, I think the way we looked at these factory workers is basically almost as if they're parts of the factory. You know, these are people coming from the countryside and they're oppressed and they go on this and they do these incredibly mind-numbing and tedious jobs. And often the conditions aren't that good and we feel sorry for them. And, you know, these are often very tough jobs and there's a lot of tough situations. But one thing that impressed me when I was there was that these people had an incredibly vibrant cultural and social lives. I mean, these were people, you know, who are from cultures where they would not leave home, where young women would not have been, you know, going alone to different parts of the country. And they suddenly had this freedom and this opportunity. And so I was really interested in their cultural life. How did they date? How were they, you know, what changed their mindsets. And this radio show was something that, that Emily talked about a lot, and her colleagues, you know, they listened to it religiously. And, you know, it was amazing because the young woman who was the host of the show had also been a factory worker, and she just called into another radio show and you know, sort of told her story and did it so eloquently.
So this was an opportunity for people to vent. Is it still on the air?
It was for advice more than that. I mean, it wasn't, you know, people would call and ask her, you know, I have a boyfriend and we're thinking about living together. Is this right? And the thing that impressed Emily and her colleagues was that there were no blanket answers. It was very individualized, and it was not, you know, limited to the traditional Chinese, you know, ideas or values. And so it was part of the way culture is changing in, you know, in the country, and particularly in places like Shenzhen.
My guest is Peter Hessler, a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he served as the Beijing correspondent from 2000 to 2007. He's also a contributing writer for the National Geographic. And his latest book is Strange Stones, Dispatches from East and West. It's published by Harper, a perennial. You interviewed a young female author of a bestseller, which was banned and censored. Why was it banned?
Basically sex. I mean, this was a book, you know, again, looking at a certain part of this new culture in Shenzhen and places like that. And she had written very openly about a woman who was a mistress to a wealthy factory owner and the kind of life that this person had. And the government felt like it was giving a bad impression of the city, so they banned it.
Well, isn't the suicide rate among women in China much higher than it is among men?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I think, the highest in the world among women. I mean, because generally women don't have a high suicide rate. Yeah.
And then, of course, there was a practice of giving female babies up for adoption for a long time. Hasn't that backfired?
I think it's really unclear at this point, what the social outcome is of that policy.
Well,
I mean,
there are a lot more males than females now, and it's harder to find a wife than it would have been in the past.
I'm not sure. You know, the thing that's interesting is in all the years that I was there, I actually never saw really tangible evidence of that. And there was so much movement in the country that I think it's very hard to pin down. Like, you go to Shenzhen, and people will tell you it's 7 women to every man, which is an exaggeration. But it's true that there are many more women there than men because that's what the market demanded, these factory workers. So, and you, when you have this sort of fluidity that you have in China, it's very hard to say, okay, let's track this community over a period of time because people are constantly moving in and out.
But what does that mean for those 7? Let's say it's 5 women to every man. Then what does that mean for social life in a city like Shenzhen? Or do people even have a social life after having worked in the factory for so many hours?
Most of them would often try to find a husband back in their home villages, and that's often what the mother was, you know, the parents were trying to get them to do. But you know, there's very active dating in those places, and now it's, you know, there's internet dating, and
you say that Chinese people are very reserved in talking about themselves and about things like this. Was it difficult to get them to open up and confide in you? And did, when you came back here and you were doing reporting, did you find Americans are quite different about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I moved back after many years in China, and it was really neat to sort of reconnect with American culture. And one thing that I realized I had missed was just the way people talk in America. I mean, Americans are storytellers, and Americans are, you know, individualists, and everybody believes that his or her story is fascinating. And you know, you can meet somebody at a bar in America, and within 5 minutes, you know, he's telling you incredibly intimate details about his life, and that just doesn't happen in China. And so it was sort of wonderful to hear people talk like that again.
You think that's good? A little discretion might be appreciated.
A little bit,
as well.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, there's a happy medium between the way people in China are and the way Americans are.
The main cities in China have been modernizing rapidly in the past 2 decades. Was there a plan to protect the old neighborhoods, the historic neighborhoods?
Not much. I mean, you know, we saw this play out a lot in Beijing, and my friend Michael Meyer, who's going to be doing the event with me tonight at the Asia Society, he wrote a book about this. But it's basically, in Beijing, you had this incredible change through the 90s and early 2000s where most of the old parts of town were torn down and modernized.
And are the residents compensated?
Yeah, they're compensated, often not really adequately. But, I mean, I think there's a high degree of passivity with response to this. And I think there's complicated reasons for that. For one thing, I don't think the Chinese, personally, I've never felt like the Chinese connect with buildings and with the past as through, you know, structures in the same way that we do as Westerners.
So what about other kinds of buildings, temples and monasteries? Were they preserved?
Often not. You know, and again, I live in Egypt now, and it's amazing to me when I go to Egypt and I look at a pyramid and I say, okay, that makes sense. That's my culture. It's, you know, this is a, I understand how this is connected to the past. But in China, you go to the, you know, you look at what their artifacts were from the earliest, and it's bronzes and writing. I mean, I just think their sense of the past is captured differently than in the Western tradition.
So there was a lot of demolition to prepare for the Olympics.
And but not just
and for the skyscrapers.
And it's not just the Olympics. I mean, this happened all over China, every city.
Peter Hessler's book is called Strange Stones, Dispatches from East and West, available now in a paperback from Harper Perennial. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Peter Hessler, whose latest book is Strange Stones, Dispatches from East and West, published by Harper Perennial. Why Strange Stones?
It's the title of a piece that's in there. It's from a Chinese term, which is qixia in Chinese. And it's a term for when they go to tourist sites, they have rock formations that they think look like an elephant or a woman, or, you know, and there's all these stories about it. And you can also buy these things at shops. And there was a trip I took with a buddy of mine from the Peace Corps, and we were driving in a godforsaken part of Hebei province and just saw these signs for strange stones everywhere, and so we finally bit and said, well, what's going on, let's see what this is about. And we walked into one of these shops, and, you know, immediately a strange stone, you know, basically exploded and fell off a shelf, and it was a scam basically, and we were the suckers. And so the story is about how that unfolds. But I like the sound of the words strange stones. I just think it's evocative, and it sort of reflects what it's like to be a reporter. You're looking for things and bringing them together.
You also went to one of the great tourist sites, the Great Wall, hiked it. Wasn't the Chinese government concerned that the Olympics were going to bring too many people to the Great Wall?
Well, I think mostly what they were concerned about was people showing up with a free Tibet banner or a Falun Gong banner and get a photo with the Great Wall in the background. And because of that concern, they had, you know, teams of peasants mobilized to basically guard the thing against all outsiders. So it's a very Chinese solution to this. I mean, bizarre, you know.
Well, they don't have a free press. It can be difficult for a foreign correspondent, can't it?
No, I mean, it's, you know, it's not like you're, as a foreign correspondent, you're publishing in America. And so the Chinese government does not tell you what to publish. But it can be difficult in the sense that if you're reporting on something sensitive, you can be harassed. But I mean, really, the concern that you have as a correspondent is the people you're writing about. It's not you. I mean, you're not at risk. You have to be careful when you're writing about somebody. If something's politically sensitive, you don't want to get that person in trouble.
Are they embarrassed about things like the pollution? You lived in Beijing, where pollution has reached hazardous levels.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not an issue of embarrassment. I mean, I think they're concerned. I mean, because this is becoming a big problem. I think citizens there are unhappy about it. And I think the government realizes that something needs to be done.
You describe one of the neighborhoods that you lived in Beijing as very crowded and very noisy. Were you able to integrate yourself into it?
You know, I mean, to some degree. I mean, I was...
You spoke Mandarin?
Yeah, I speak Mandarin Chinese, and I would hang out with the local guys. I mean, they had a group of them that hung out at one part of the Hutong, and I would spend time with them.
You wrote about a bike repairer who worked in your alley and arranged a blind date for you.
Yeah.
Is that common?
Yeah, it wasn't too common, but it happened there. I mean, yeah, there was, you know, a bike repairman is a very important position in a Chinese hutong, you know, because everybody, and he just knows a lot. And so sometimes, like, one time he'd give me somebody's business card and say, hey, this person's looking for you. And so I'd get these messages from him. And then at one point he said, hey, you know, I talked to the matchmaker, and, you know, there's somebody she wants you to meet, and she's 1.63 meters tall, which is a big deal in China. When you're, like,
I say she's a tall girl, so.
That's not that tall. It's like 5'3", but basically, if you're not over 1.6 and you're a woman, then you don't want to advertise whatever your height is. So anyway, Lao Yang, who was the bike repairman, told me, you know, she wants you to meet this person. I said, hey, you know, that's fine, but I'm I'm busy and I'm not really interested right now. And he's like, no, you have to go. I've already set this up, and I'm going to lose face if you don't do this. So I went on the date with a 1.63 meter woman.
One date.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was sort of a minor disaster. I describe it in the book.
Now, is that common, blind dating? This is kind of matchmaking. But it's not matchmaking in
this was
the Indian sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, this was a formal matchmaker. I mean, since she was government licensed, then you would pay a fee and so on, and that used to play a bigger role. And I think nowadays that is. And by the time I did this story, that was already starting to become less common. I think now people rely a lot on social network. Just like they do in the States.
Well, how much did your staying there require you getting over all sorts of culture shock things? Like, you write about a restaurant where rats are served as a delicacy. Are rats considered luxury food in China?
No.
They must be pretty easy to catch.
Most parts of China they wouldn't, but this was in the South China. In South China, they eat pretty much anything. And this was a village that they had just started, I guess, to brand their local specialty of rat and were, telling people that it was, good for your hair and all kinds of. They told me that it would, keep my hair from going gray. And I haven't gone gray yet, so maybe it worked.
So you ate the rat?
I ate two rats, yeah.
And it tasted like chicken, I'm sure.
Not exactly, actually. I mean, it probably was better than chicken, I have to say. But it's hard to get the image of the rat out of your head, and especially because, they showed me the rat before I ate it, and they showed me the live rat, and then I watched them kill it.
But there are other foods that are also considered delicacies in China that have led to problems. Rare animals and birds, a reason that some diseases like SARS have originated in China. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and that all happens down in the south. So, which is the area when I went, that's where I was going to the rat restaurant as well. Yeah, yeah, no, it's it's heavily populated area. There's a lot of contact between people and livestock and animals. And so a lot of these, risks of an epidemic come from there.
What about the other side? Are there a lot of Western restaurants popping up in China?
Yeah, I mean, Beijing was a great food city. I mean, it's an amazing place because it's at this stage where there is enough of a market, there's enough middle class and upper class that you kind of have everything, but it's still not ridiculously expensive, and so you could eat incredibly well in Beijing.
So fancy French restaurants, Italian restaurants, but also McDonald's.
Great, yeah, of course, McDonald's. Yeah. Great Japanese restaurants, and yeah, just everything, basically.
You met with Yao Ming, the now-retired basketball star for the NBA, and learned about the sports system in China. Is it very different than ours?
Yeah, I mean, I profiled him in his rookie season, and it was just an incredible experience because the poor guy was just totally overwhelmed by all this attention. But he handled it with remarkable grace. I mean, he's a very intelligent person, and really decent and patient. I mean, the sports system there is still pretty government centered, and so the government sets up these sports schools and kids are chosen at an early age. You don't have the kind of organic, just pure competitive, system that you have in the States, and as a result it's less effective. I mean, basically for a sport like basketball. That's why, I mean, now I did that story on Yao Ming in his rookie year, and I asked him at one point, and there was all this talk at that time like, oh, the Chinese are gonna, this is gonna be this huge basketball boom, and I asked him 10 years from now how many Chinese are gonna be in the NBA, and he said 3 or 4. That's it. He said there's not going to be more than that. And he actually, that's too many. There's not even that many now.
And one of them, Jeremy Lin, is actually born in the United States and he's Taiwanese.
Yeah,
he
is.
But in the case of Yao Ming, was he chosen for basketball simply because he was a tall kid?
Yeah, he was taller than his teacher in first grade.
So I assume that they look at your bone structure and say, swimmer, diver, gymnastics, runner.
It has a lot to do with your height. It also has a lot to do with where you're from, in the sense that if you're a middle class family in China and somebody comes to you and says, your kid has a good bone structure to become a wrestler or something, you're going to say no thanks because I want my kid to be a banker or a lawyer or something, And so most people in China don't want this. And actually Yao's parents resisted. I mean, his parents were both products of the sports system. They were incredibly tall. His father had played for the provincial team, his mother for the national team. And they weren't that excited about him becoming an athlete. They resisted.
Well, what's the level of I know that water sports, China dominates at the Olympics. But what about something like basketball? You have to be good, you have to play against other people who are good.
Of course. And you can't – how are you going to pick a good point guard? You got Allen Iverson, his mother's 4'8" or whatever, and he's living in some rough part of – you know, Newport News. I mean, who's going to find that kid in a system like China's? It doesn't happen. That kid doesn't develop. Whereas in America, I mean, you know, you just have this sort of very natural, highly competitive, and that's why you don't have any guards in China who are good. And Jeremy Lin, of course, is a product of the American system. He's not a product of China.
Is Yao Ming a super, super, superstar in China?
Yeah, I think he's in there. I think he's a representative in the government actually now. And he does. I mean, he's retired. He had to retire very early, and it's partly because of the system there. Because the years he was playing with the Rockets, he would have to go back and play with the Chinese national team, and they'd have practice at like 6 a.m, and then they'd have another practice at 3 p.m. You've got a guy who's like 7'6". You cannot do that to him, you know. And I went and visited him the day after he signed what was probably the biggest endorsement deal by any professional athlete. And he was with the Chinese team playing a tournament, and he's in a hotel, and he's got a bed that's a hotel bed. This is a pretty crappy Chinese government-run guest house, and he's got like a chest of drawers at the bottom of the bed, so he can put his feet because he doesn't even fit. So this guy couldn't even get a bed that fit him, you know. And he's an athlete of this level, so it's no surprise his career ended.
Well, thinking back over the history of Olympics within recent memory. East Germany dominated swimming for a while and some other sports, track and field, Romania, gymnastics, and also the Soviet Union. And it was all because of their training programs. China is a latecomer to all of this, but they've done exceedingly well in recent years. Did they consider the 2008 Olympics a major success for themselves?
I think they did. I mean, the bottom line is that it's pretty easy to compete at most Olympic sports because they're not, you know, they're not that competitive in the grand scheme of things. So you can create a program. If you're willing to invest in it, any country can do this. And we see it, you know, even in London, there was a significant investment when they saw the Olympics. We're going to have the Olympics of this period. We want to be ready and have some athletes. And they did much better in those Olympics than they had in the past. So it's not that hard to do in these low competition events. How many kids do gymnastics? You know, how many people are involved in water polo? I mean, these are sports you can build. But something like basketball, you can't build like that.
China had to face many problems in 2008. A few months before the games, there were riots in Tibet, an earthquake that killed 6,000 people, and we're still feeling some of the repercussions of that. How did China overcome those obstacles before the opening ceremony? Just simply squelching news of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically with a situation like Tibet. I mean, and that's an ongoing problem. I mean, there just have been an incredible, the last couple of years, the immolations, many monks in Tibet setting themselves on fire. You know, the Chinese strategy is to keep that news out. I mean, as a journalist, for example, you can't go to Tibet. You know, I could not go to Tibet and report a story. It's closed, you know, to people who are writing about the country.
Well, right now we've been hearing that amateur reporters are taking the place of real journalists. How much do the Chinese people know about what's really going on in their country?
I mean, they know about local issues, and you do have, I think especially when you look at environmental issues in China, you see that the local response drives a lot of, a lot of the awareness. And that's sort of an interesting issue now in China because the government is willing to respond to that. The government is not willing to respond. It doesn't matter how many people protest in Tibet. The government is not going to change their system there. But with environmental issues and local pollution and things like that, they often respond to try to make people happier.
Well, they pick and choose. If it's somebody who's favored by the government who's doing the polluting, nothing happens. But if it's somebody who they feel perfectly happy to crack down on, then they will crack down on them.
Yeah, it's not a system in the sense that it's not a predictable, transparent, you know, logical system. It's case by case.
How big is the car industry in China? Have cars been made in China for a long time,
or
is
this a recent? It's the biggest market in the world and the biggest producers in the world. I mean, I live in Cairo now, and as most of the cars I see are Chinese made now. I mean, so they're huge in those markets. They have not yet been able to produce cars of the level that we're going to see in the States or Japan or Europe.
But were they always making cars? Because my image of China during the Mao years was a lot of bicycles and a couple of cars.
Yeah, no, there wasn't a big market for it. In this book, I profile Chery, which was a company, a Chinese car company that's become one of the leaders of their industry, and the CEO of the company, when I interviewed him, he said, "Yeah, when I was in school, you were put on two tracks, and one track was for the trucks and the heavy vehicles, and the other track was the passenger vehicles. And because I was a bad student, I was put on the passenger vehicles because that didn't matter in 1970s. There was no future for it. So that's the way it was, a generation ago.
And then you left China. Why?
I'd been there for more than a decade. I was very happy there. I liked it. But I felt like, it's a big world, and I don't want to just write about one place.
Had America changed a lot? Oh, had you been coming back?
I've been making trips back. It's not the same as living there. And that was another concern. Because I had left America even before I went to China, because I lived in England and Europe before that. So I was basically 15 years that I hadn't lived in the States. And, I wanted to reconnect a little bit. I also wanted to write stories here. I wanted to have that experience.
Well, most people move back. They don't move to Nuclea, Colorado. I never even heard of Nuclea.
Yeah,
N-U-C-L-A.
I moved to Ridgway, which is pretty close to Nuclea, but also pretty small. The place I moved to, Ridgway, had about 700, population about 700. There's one traffic light in the county.
Well, your last chapter, that's why I mentioned Nuclea, is about Nuclea, which has a peculiar story. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah, this is an area that's in the far southwest, the Four Corners part of the country, close to New Mexico and Arizona. And I started going down there because they have a huge uranium industry, and they were sort of, they were trying to restart this. And so I did a piece on the uranium industry.
This is near the Osage Reservation?
No, it's...
Because that's right on the bottom of Colorado.
It's a little further up from that, and it's very west, very close to Utah, basically, mm-hmm. on the very close to the Utah border. It's actually where they mined some of the uranium that was used in the bombs in the World War II. But I just got interested in this community. And in the course of doing the story on the uranium, I just noticed everybody local was telling me, you have a question about that? Talk to Don. Well, who's Don? He's the pharmacist. He knows everything. And so I got interested in this guy, and I started researching his story. He's just a small-town pharmacist in an area where you've got a two-hour drive to a hospital. And, he's just an incredibly important figure in that community.
So he functions kind of as a de facto doctor, even though he doesn't have a medical degree?
He's a doctor. He's an investment advisor, everything. I mean, there's, somebody had problems with his stock certificates, and he goes to Don. I mean, whatever they need, they go to Don.
And now you lived in Cairo, as you say. Did the Arab Spring bring you there?
No. I mean, actually, when we left China in 2007, my wife Leslie and I, and we decided that we were going to live in the States for a few years and then go somewhere else. And at that point, we made the decision to move to the Middle East. And it was before this political moment.
Are you concerned about how the changes in Egypt are turning out?
I mean, I think this is a very rough phase. I mean, I think it's very hard to see political direction at the top. And it's rough. It's going to continue to be rough. And the other side of it, though, is that when you live there and you're on the street every day, it's amazing how functional things continue to be. And people continue to treat each other decently. It's felt very safe for me and my wife and our children. So, I mean, I think that's the flip side. Things, you have this very tough situation at the top, but there are certain values and traditions that are kind of holding society together.
Well, there are people who feel that the situation isn't all that different than it was under Mubarak. It just... Now the Muslim Brotherhood is making those decisions. Are we likely to start seeing the kinds of protests we saw that ended the Mubarak regime?
Well, yeah, we're seeing the protests are just happening all the time. I think there's no question about that. But I think there's a difference. The Muslim Brotherhood is not a powerful organization now. They've won some elections, but they do not have they just don't have the support necessary to institute a true repressive state. So it doesn't mean that's not going to happen by somebody else, but I don't think that's the organization that's going
to. Well, they'd have to have the cooperation of the military
and the police, and uh-huh. Both of those, especially the police, dislike the Muslim Brotherhood and also the government. I mean, this is there's huge number this massive civil service in Egypt, and most of those employees are not fond of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, we also have problems with minorities, Shiites and Copts especially are suffering as a result of the new regime. Are they being overblown in the Western press?
There have been things that happen, but I think it's on the whole, it's held together. I've been doing research in Upper Egypt, in the south and rural areas, and I'm in a community that has a sizable Christian population, and nothing has happened there. There's been no tension between those groups. There's been other problems, but not sectarian.
Peter Hessler will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 6:30 at the Asia Society. That's at Park Avenue and 70th Street. His latest book, Strange Stones, Dispatches from East and West, is published by Harper Perennial. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.